alone in the universe? Maybe that's not actually the right question.
The irony is that we're not alone. We don't have to look beyond where we are right now. That we're surrounded by intimacy. We're surrounded by this larger conversation between other animals and with other animals, and also plants. Far more is now known about how trees communicate, not only with each other, but plants communicate with animals. So this is I call it the great whisper, which is all around us if we pay attention.
That's Richard Loeb, author of Last Child in the Woods. We talk with him about his new book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Later, we play an excerpt from our 2015 interview with Carl Safina about his book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Richard Loeb's landmark book, Last Child in the Woods, inspired an international movement to connect children and nature. Now Loeb redefines the future of human-animal coexistence. Our Wild Calling explores the powerful and mysterious bonds between humans and animals and how they can transform our mental, physical, and spiritual lives. They also can serve as an antidote to the growing epidemic of human loneliness and help us tap into the empathy required to preserve life on Earth. Richard Loeb is a journalist and author of 10 books. They include, in addition to Our Wild Calling and Last Child in the Woods, The Nature Principle and Vitamin N, The Essential Guide to Nature. He's co-founder of the Children and Nature Network. Well, Richard Loeb, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is such a beautiful book, Our Wild Calling. You start the book with an encounter with a black fox. Tell us about that encounter.
Well, I was on Kodiak Island with my son, and he was working as a guide in the lodge there. And I was on my way to the lodge, and I had my head down looking at my wallet because he was my guide, so I needed to tip him. And you're not supposed to look at your wallet when you're walking around Kodiak Island because there's so many Alaskan brown bears, which are huge grizzlies, and they walk right through camp. And so I wasn't paying attention. And suddenly I was confronted by these amazingly, startlingly bright eyes, piercing eyes. And fortunately, it wasn't a bear. It was a fox. And the foxes on Kodiak Island are among the largest in the world. And this fox blocked my path, and he wouldn't get out of my way. And he just stared at me. And I was really struck by his eyes. I was struck by what I saw or didn't see, or what the mystery was there, what I felt when I looked into those eyes. And I thought, is he rabid? He's not getting out of my way. He's not afraid of me. He's standing 3 feet in front of me. So finally, I just moved a little bit forward, and he moved to the side. And I said, you want to go with me to the lodge? I'm going up to the lodge. And he trotted along next to me until he moved off into the weeds and disappeared. I asked the lodge. They were not feeding that fox. There was something else going on there. I don't think he was sick. I don't think he was rabid. I think, you know, in the introduction of the book where I described that, I think he was telling me to pay attention. And that encounter made me very curious about what was happening during those moments. And I didn't have an answer then. So the focus of the book, the search of the book, is really what happens between us and another animal. And I mean literally between us, if it's a wild animal or if it's a pet. And so the book is a lot of stories that have been sent to me or I've collected or I've interviewed people about that moment or about their relationships with other animals. And these are often very profound stories that people tell, and they get more meaningful as people tell them.
More meaningful as people tell them? Why is that?
I think that this is deep within us. This is deep within our species. I mean, tens of thousands of years ago, when we were early on this planet, we would go out and do our work during the day and hunt and survive. And then we'd come back to the fire at night, and we would tell stories. We'd tell animal stories. Sometimes we would act out those stories. We would dance. We would become the bear or the fox. And this is deep within us. We have a need to tell these stories. And those stories for our ancestors had deep meaning that grew into myth. And our encounters with animals have deeper meaning as we retell them. They become, in a sense, personal myths. So the nature of that meaning is also what the book is about.
Yeah, it's interesting. You write about this, and I was struck about how humans often regard animal encounters as omens, which is really ascribing meaning to those encounters. And that really hit me because back in June of 2012, I was out on my bike prior to going to visit my mother, who was in the hospital, and we all knew she was in hospice, basically in the hospital, palliative care. And I saw a cormorant catching an eel. And then 5 minutes later, I was hit by a truck.
Oh, my gosh.
And I ended up in a hospital room, one floor above my mother, who was dying. And I've always felt, and I cannot explain this, but I've always felt that there was an association between the two events, that one was an omen of the other. It was a very striking thing. And I'm just going to ask you, what do you make of that story?
Now, when you saw that cormorant, was that the reason you had the accident? Because you were distracted, or did I miss something?
No, I wasn't, but I felt that it was filled, that it was an omen. I just felt so strongly when I saw that creature that it was an omen of something. And then I was hit, and I was, you know, I mean, I was in a cast for 4 months, but there was no lasting damage. But it was all connected with the sense that this was an omen of some, that like what you just said, I had to pay attention. And believe me, when I was in the hospital, you know, one floor above my mother, I mean, I got to spend a lot more time with her than I would have if I hadn't been in the hospital.
Well, in the studies of, you know, the meaning that we either ascribe or come to us through animals. And by the way, I'm not sure I care whether we have projected that meaning into the experience or the experience actually has that meaning and the animal is trying to communicate to us in some way. I'm not sure that that matters because we still find meaning. In the studies of this kind of thing, birds are often the messengers of death, particularly owls. But I, you know, that is quite a striking image of the cormorant and the eel. I'm not sure what to make of that. I'm sure you know better what to make of that. Did you tell your mother that story?
No, I didn't, but I did tell my other family.
What did they think of it?
It made total sense to them without them even knowing why either.
Well, this is part of what comes through. I mean, in the stories and that are told to me in the book from all kinds of different people, including hardcore, stern, very stern scientists who also have these experiences, like the oceanographer who had a transcendent experience with an octopus, a 12-foot span octopus. These stories are all around us. And I think that this language is all around us, that we have a ring of communication around us all the time. And it's in what I call the oldest language, which precedes verbal language. And it is not only around us, it is between us and another animal. Now, many of us experienced that when we were kids with our dog, for instance, or a cat, a pet. We knew about that when we were kids. And as we grow up, we tend to lose that or be talked out of it. But one of the experiences I described in the book is my own experience being on a lake in a boat. It was early morning. I have a little electric motor, so it's very quiet. And I saw on the shore what I thought were two vultures, and I eased up very carefully. And they were not vultures. They were two giant golden eagles, and they were eating a dead carp on the shore. And for what seemed like forever, They looked at me and I looked at them. They would go down and get a bite of the fish, their eyes never leaving mine. Then they would go back up and keep looking at me. When I say this seemed to go on forever, many of the stories that I collected from people talked about different kinds of altered states that people feel when they have these experiences, one of which is that time either bends or disappears. One person called it the sense of being in whole time. So this went on for quite a while, and then I finally had to go. I felt something change between the eagles and me, and I'm not speaking for the eagles. They may have just been trying to decide if I was edible. But I went home, and I talked to my younger son, who was home from college, and I told him about that. And I said, Matthew, whoever I say I am, I'm not. Whoever I was in those moments is who I actually am, and I don't have the words to explain this. This is beyond human language, beyond verbal. And much of some of the research has actually suggested that there is a kind of universal language, a super language, or the oldest language, as I call it, that many species share, and we can be sensitized to if we work at it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Richard Louvre about his latest book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. And about this oldest language, you even talk about, well, one thing you say is that we have more senses than we think and that we can use them in human-animal communication. Say more about that.
Well, the people who study the human senses no longer talk about only five senses. They talk conservatively about 9 or 10. Some scientists talk about as many as 30 human senses, and some even more than that. And they all have names. We have some of the ability of bats to use echolocation to make our way around in a dark room. Some people who have lost their sight are learning how to do that. We have some bloodhound in us, in a sense. We can follow a trail, a scent trail through the forest on our hands and knees with our eyes covered and our ears plugged. And the people doing that study said that the college students, who were the guinea pigs in this case, who followed that scent trail, did something unexpected that all animals who make their living with their noses do. The students zigzagged as they followed that trail. So this is part of us. This is deep within us, these different senses. But what we do, and I write about this quite a bit in my other books about, including Last Child in the Woods, which was about what I call nature deficit disorder. What we do is we sit in front of screens all day, and I do this, and we set up learning environments for our kids at school where we've canceled recess often, where we have them in front of screens all the time. And much of that time, we're spending, and they're spending, a lot of energy trying to push out and block as many of those many, many senses as we can so that we can concentrate on that screen. And through a couple senses, allegedly go anywhere in the universe through the internet. I think that's the very definition of being less alive. I don't know any parents who want their kids to be less alive. So we have these senses, but we don't use them very much. So much of this book is about how animals bring us alive. Other animals, we're animals too, that those animals bring us alive to those senses if we pay attention.
Yeah, absolutely. And something very interesting is that there are even some people who are working on technology that would enable us to eventually talk with other animals. I'd like you to, you know, say what that is and also how revolutionary that would be.
There's one scientist whose name I can't pronounce, but he talks about his study of prairie dogs and their language. And it turns out that prairie dogs are good journalists and they don't deal in fake news. The prairie dogs at the edge of a prairie dog colony can see somebody or something coming, and they can describe it in some detail. They can say whether it has a white hat on, what kind of animal it is, what its intentions seem to be. And with its language, it can pass that on to the next prairie dog and then the next and the next. And pretty soon the whole colony knows about what this thing is that's approaching them in some detail. The scientist has been using digital technology to record and then using computers to decode that language. And it's probably the most sophisticated animal language that's yet been decoded. And he says that they string together clusters of sounds into something like sentences, and that through artificial intelligence and the use of computers and digital technology, he may be able, or they may be able soon, to be able to feed prairie dog language into a computer and then decode it and have us hear the prairie dogs speaking in whatever our language is, in English, for example. And the reverse could be true. We could talk to the prairie dogs in prairie dog language. Now, some of this experimentation is a little strange. There's some people working on special dog leashes that would be attached to a vest on a dog that could actually tell us more about what the dog is smelling, what the dog is thinking about. I think that that is a little overdoing it. We've had 30,000 years at least of co-evolution with dogs. We pretty much know what they're thinking, and they pretty much know what we're thinking by now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was some recent research that showed that it actually was their ability to make a connection to us. I don't know, you may know this research better. It happened about, I read about it about a week ago, that what makes that for that special relationship is the dog's ability to create an empathic bond with us.
Yeah, absolutely. And there has been research recently. In fact, there's another new book out that it's coming out. I think it's called Dog is Love. And it's fascinating because it shows how dogs really do feel love for us, but they feel love for anything that they had an early attachment to. If they grow up with sheep, they have they have a sense of love for sheep. So we have this empathy with dogs. They have it with us, and this comes in part through centuries of coevolution, thousands of years. But it also comes individually. I talk about my dog in the book, whose name was Banner, and he and I had an very intense bond. He was a collie. We spent most of our life, most of my boyhood years and its puppy years in the woods. You know, my parents didn't know where we were, but my dog did. And that empathy that I felt for him and he felt for me was intense. And some of the studies really suggest that having animals in their lives really build empathy in children. And this is one of the important gifts that other animals give us. One thing I wanted to say is a story I started to tell about the two eagles on the shore. I tried to figure out what was going on there. And again, I can't speak for the eagles. But what I felt and what so many people who tell me the stories in these books in this book feel is that there was something between us. And the great philosopher, Martin Buber, I have to often be careful not to say Justin Bieber. Martin Buber, the philosopher, talked about in his essay, I Am Thou, a famous essay, when he was talking about the relationship between people, he said that you and I don't actually exist. What exists is between us, the relationship. And he meant that in a different way than many of us use that word relationship. He thought of it as a kind of electricity that some people call God. That's what people describe to me. And that's what I felt in those moments is something between us. And sometimes it's with another person and sometimes it's with another animal. And we're just not very sensitized to feeling that, certainly not with wild animals. But when we begin to notice it, it's all around us. And I think that this has something to do with our sense of loneliness in the world. And by the way, I tried to name that thing between us and another animal. It doesn't really have a name, so I called it the habitat of the heart. And I believe that there are two habitats. There's the physical habitat that we work very hard to protect for other animals and for ourselves. But then there's this habitat of the heart. And we don't do very much to try to protect or to nurture that. And the thing is that if one of those two habitats goes, so does the other. And I actually think that this is part of the future of environmentalism, to begin to pay as much attention to the habitat of the heart as we do to the physical.
You have a term called solifilia. What is that?
Solastalgia is a term created by a philosopher in Australia, Glenn Albrecht, to describe that intense a kind of a homesickness we feel about the home that is being torn down around us. It's not for a home in the past, long ago. It's for the home we're in right now. He also talks about solophilia, which is the love of life, like biophilia is the love of life. But he has another term, which is a replacement he feels that we ought to use for the term that's often used, which is that we are in the Anthropocene geological era. He doesn't like that because that is focused on human beings at the center by the definition of that term. So he talks about the
Ecozoic.
That's Thomas Berry who talks about that, which is a similar meaning, but the symbiocene is what Glenn talks about in terms of that's what we ought to be. We ought to be skipping the Anthropocene, which is human-centered, and going to the symbiocene, which is a concept of being in symbiosis with all of life, that we're all in this together, and we're not necessarily in charge. We have to have some partners in this.
Yes. You know, you say this on the day that I'm talking with you now. It's the same day that the UN just came out with another dire warning of where we are headed in terms of climate change. Everybody knows that we have to get off of the fossil fuel era, and yet emissions are still going up. So say more about the symbiocene, because it's not just a concept. You flesh it out in the book with some pretty interesting ideas about what it would mean to live our lives with the full recognition that we are in a symbiotic relationship with everything else around us.
E.O. Wilson, the great scientist at Harvard, who has talked about the biophilia hypothesis, he didn't make up the word biophilia, which is love of life, but he did popularize it, and particularly in this biophilia hypothesis, which holds that we are genetically wired as a species to have a need for other species, to have an affiliation with the rest of nature, and that when we don't get that, we don't do so well. He talks about the Anthropocene as actually the age of loneliness. Where that leads, if you follow our logic in terms of us being the center of all of it and responsible for all of it, and in fact destroying a lot of it, is it will be down to a few domestic animals and us. And he describes that as the age of loneliness. There are other people who have talked about this in terms of species loneliness, that our human loneliness that we feel that is now seen as an epidemic by many medical people, including the World Health Organization, who say that human loneliness, social isolation, will soon outdistance obesity as a cause of early death. Not only because of suicide, but because of all of the diseases that are attached to human loneliness that come along with that. I make the case in the book that this human loneliness and this epidemic of it is rooted in a deeper loneliness. This is species loneliness. We are desperate not to be alone in the universe and not to feel that way. The parks, the urban parks that have the highest benefit for human psychological health happen to be the parks with the highest biodiversity. Again, I don't think that's an accident. We need to feel connected in the universe and not alone. I mean, why else would we look for Bigfoot? Because we have this desperate need. Why else would we look for intelligent life on other planets? It's not just curiosity, is we don't want to be alone in the universe. That may not be a good idea to find that intelligent life. Stephen Hawking has warned us, by the way. And in fact, the irony is that we're not alone. We don't have to look beyond where we are right now, that we are surrounded by intimacy. We are surrounded by this larger conversation between other animals and with other animals, and also plants, far more as now known about how trees communicate, not only with each other, but plants communicate with animals. So this is I call it the great whisper, which is all around us if we pay attention. Your question, though, is more about what would the symbiocene look like? I spend a section in the book talking about what our cities could be. I think our cities could be engines of biodiversity, not just the enemy of biodiversity. We could change them through what's called biophilic design, which creates different kinds of workplaces and schools and homes that are infused with natural elements around and in them. The workplaces that have been designed in this way, the studies show that people in them are far more productive. Sick time is reduced, turnover of employees is reduced. What if whole cities could be like that? And I think they can. If we look at our backyards, for instance, there's a great book, Bringing Nature Home, Doug Ptolemy has written, that I cite, that talks about creating a homegrown national park. And by that he means, what if our yards were turned into native species? You know, all through our cities, we would have wildlife corridors on private land created by all of us that would produce the insects that are fast being exterminated as well, that provide the basis for the food chain, for birds, for all of life eventually. We can do this where we live. We don't have to wait. And in doing that, it produces more connection between us and the rest of life, which reduces our loneliness, which the studies have shown improve our physical health, our psychological health, our emotional health, and I would argue our spiritual health. In the prior books, I really focused on children and how it affects them. But I think that this focusing on animals, which I've done in this newest book, Our Wild Calling, is a place that most of us can understand more immediately than perhaps we can connecting with the plants in our yard. Sometimes other people have more of a sense of that connection to plants, but I think particularly for kids, animals are more immediate, particularly mammals.
And Richard Louv, in Our Wild Calling, you also talk about the kind of awareness. I mean, we've been talking about that all along here, but very specifically, I was struck by one of the things that you said, because I think it's a practice that we could actually use every day, which is to check to see if an animal pattern changes due to our presence. And that could be, as you say, whether through the intrusion of a single footstep or scaling it all the way up to the climate crisis, an awareness of every moment of interaction that we have with the world and the living beings around us.
There's a fellow named John Young that I profile in the book that I've known for many years. He takes hundreds of people into the forest to learn bird language, literally to learn bird language, not so much to talk to them, but to listen to them, to pay attention. And this language, this oldest language, which I mentioned earlier, is not only made up of sounds, it's made up of behaviors and patterns that seem to transcend species. Birds have calls that ground squirrels understand and will actually mimic to warn other ground squirrels, for instance, the alarm sounds that birds make, if we pay attention. And he talks about ripples, which is the term he uses for the effect that we have as individuals when we enter any environment, whether it's a cocktail party or a forest, and that everyone around us feels our presence consciously or unconsciously when we enter their territory. And those ripples can be good or they can be bad. And we see a lot of the bad ones around us, but we can also have ones that are a lot more like kindness than the ones we usually send out. And animals really respond to that, by the way.
Yes. I just saw the movie about Mr. Rogers with Tom Hanks. And, you know, Fred Rogers was doing that in the human world in the way that you're really talking about in a larger world. And he also makes the point in the movie and elsewhere that it's all about relationship, that we are not things just colliding in the night, that we are all in relationship with each other.
And that is true. And most of the time when we talk about that, we talk about other human beings. And our wild calling really is about the same thing in a sense, but it's with the life around us, the other creatures that we share the earth with. And I have an experience that I had with Mr. Rogers. I went to interview him many, many years ago. I took my then five-year-old Matthew with me. It's one of the only times I've seen Matthew speechless. And I had a question for Mr. Rogers. And we were sitting there and I said, you know, Matthew asked me this question the other day at 5 years old, and I don't have a good answer for it. And the question is, are God and Mother Nature married or just good friends? And like you, I laughed when Matthew asked me that question. Mr. Rogers did not. And, you know, after a while, he and Matthew ended up over in the corner having this long discussion about this question. And when they came back to me, Fred Rogers said to Matthew, Matthew, as you grow older, would you let me know the answer that you come to on your own to that question? I never heard the detail, really, of what they were talking about, what conclusion they'd come to. But years later, I see Matthew typing feverishly at my wife's computer in the next room. And he, at 16, I think, was sending a letter to Mr. Rogers. He printed it out, he put it in the mail, he sent it. And a couple weeks later, we got a letter from Mr. Rogers saying, thanking Matthew for sharing what he had come to understand about whether God and Mother Nature are married or good friends. And he said, say hello to your dad too. And we've got that letter framed on the wall. But I think that understanding that Fred Rogers had, as you point out, can really be applied to our relationship with all of life around us. And that this is essential. We can't just deal with climate change and biodiversity collapse by talking about data. Mm-hmm. So much of biology and science has been reduced to data. When you talk to the most enlightened scientists, for example, Einstein, you know, he had a sign on his door. It says, not everything that counts in life can be counted. And this is essential, I think, to our connection with other life.
Richard Louv. Stay tuned for more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Be sure to go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter, and much, much more. We're talking with Richard Louv about his latest book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. You know, as I was reading your book, you know, there was this undercurrent of grief. You know, for example, you point out that in Bolivia, they put into the Constitution the law of the rights of Mother Earth, of Pachamama. Yet that president who did that has been overthrown, and the person who has, you know, called herself a self-appointed president in his place said, we're going to replace Pachamama with, you know, Christianity, which seemed to be really missing the point. Everywhere we see, it's not a good picture, we see. And yet this book is really profoundly hopeful. You talk about the kind of consciousness that you feel really is beginning to take hold. So I'm sure you have a certain element of that grief in you as well. I wonder if you could talk about that and the hope that you express in this wonderful book.
Well, thank you. I think 13 or 14 years ago was the publication of Last Child in the Woods. And that book, to my surprise, which talked about what I called nature deficit disorder, really took off. It became a phenomenon. It's hard to watch the growth of that phenomenon and not be hopeful. That led to the Children of Nature Network, which is a nonprofit that led or stimulated or helped grow, which was, I believe it was already growing or about to grow, a worldwide movement to connect kids to nature. That movement has has made many improvements in life. There are now, the number of nature-based preschools has increased about 500%. We see recess, I think, for other reasons, but also for this disconnect from nature, beginning to come back in school districts. We see the growth of biophilic architecture. We see, you know, the return of the idea that education has something to do with the experiences we have in the real world, that it's not just data. We have parents all over the country and now all over Canada and the world who are creating family nature clubs, which are groups of families that band together to defy their fear of strangers and have nature experiences together. The Family Nature Club in San Diego, where we recently moved from, now has between 2,000 and 3,000 families in it. Families, not individuals. You know, we see a lot changing now on that issue. And I found that it doesn't matter what somebody's politics or religion is. You know, they all want to tell me about the treehouse they had when they were kids. If they were old enough, if they are old enough today to have had that experience when they were kids. And nobody, no matter what their politics, wants this to be the last generation to have the chance to go out in the woods and lie in the grass and watch the leaves move. Nobody wants to be in that generation. So this is actually a unifying cause. You can't look, personally, I can't look at the growth of that movement without being hopeful. And I think that this book, which is about a relationship with other animals, in many ways is the next stage. Most of the research on the impact of the natural world on our children's and our health and cognition and ability to create, most of that research has been on green space. There's the assumption made that there are animals in that green space, but primarily it's about the impact of vegetation on us. That research has gone from about 60 studies that I could find when I wrote Last Child in the Woods to nearly 1,000 studies today, and they all tend to point in the same direction. But animals are missing from that research. Wild animals are. Domestic animals, because of the growth of animal-assisted therapy, with equine therapy, with horses, with dogs, with companion animals, all of that has grown on the domestic side. But we've seen very little research about the impact of wild animals on our lives, on our health. And that includes the coyote walking through our backyard in an urban place. Increasingly, wild animals are moving into cities. So we need to pay attention to that. We need to know what is coming into our cities and understand it. And then we have two choices. We can either exterminate the wildlife coming into our cities, which many people want to do, or we can understand it, protect us, protect it, and protect ourselves and other human beings from it when we need to. And I have an idea about how to do that, but my answer has been way too long. So.
Oh, well, I'm curious about that. And how would one do that?
Well, I mentioned the growth of the family nature clubs. What if we had something like that, something like Neighborhood Watch, which is set up in neighborhoods to watch for strangers and to watch for elements of crime? What if we had something like that called Neighborhood Wild Watch, which would be, you know, your kids, parents, the retirees at the end of the corner, who would create local clubs in their neighborhoods to watch the animals, to watch not only the domestic animals, but watch the wild animals that are coming into the neighborhoods at ever-increasing numbers, and to understand them. And they're fascinating. I mean, this would add, I think, interest and joy to people's lives, but also to do two things: to protect people from the ones that they need protecting from. For instance, the animals that are too aggressive, the animals that look sick, and to know what to do when they see that coyote that is too aggressive, but also to train the other neighbors, to teach them not to feed the animals. Not good for the animals, not good for us, the wild animals. And then also to protect those wild animals by understanding them more, by respecting them more, by recognizing the joy and the stories that they give us. If we did that in an organized way with these family, with these neighborhood animal watch groups all over our cities, all over our country and the world, I think we would experience something, I think, profoundly good for our species. That would be one way to deal with our species loneliness. That way, by the way, also increases social capital among people. It creates connections among people. And I would say as an aside, John Young, that I mentioned earlier, who teaches bird language, mm-hmm. he talks about how people who learn this bird language about it by paying attention, they go home and they find their relationships with their spouses are better. And John has a short explanation. He says they find they're actually listening to their spouses.
That's wonderful. Well, great story. Among many great stories in this book, Our Wild Calling, How Connecting with Animals Can Transform Our Lives and Save Theirs. Richard Loeb, it has been just a delight to talk with you about this book.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thanks for this program, too.
Richard Loeb, author of 10 books and co-founder of the Children and Nature Network. Find a link to the Children and Nature Network at writersvoice.net. Carl Safina is a famed conservation biologist and MacArthur Genius Award recipient. His 2015 book, Beyond Words, was a milestone in bringing a greater understanding to the public about how animals think and feel. It's an eloquent plea for a major reset on how humans regard our fellow animals. I spoke with him in 2015 at his home in Lazy Point, a neighborhood in Amagansett, New York, that was the eponymous subject of a previous book of his. I started out by asking Carl Safina to read a passage from his book. The very first paragraph in the book, it's in the prologue. It's Into the Mind Field is the name of the chapter.
Another big group of dolphins had just surfaced alongside our moving vessel, leaping and splashing and calling mysteriously back and forth in their squealy, whistly way, with many babies swift alongside their mothers. And this time, confined to just the surface of such deep and lovely lives, I was becoming unsatisfied. I wanted to know what they were experiencing and why to us they feel so compelling and so close. This time I allowed myself to ask them the question that is forbidden fruit. Who are you? Science usually steers firmly from questions about the inner lives of animals. Surely they have inner lives of some sort, but like a child who is admonished that what they really want to ask is impolite, a young scientist is taught that the animal mind, if there is such, is unknowable. Permissible questions are it questions, about where it lives, what it eats, what it does when danger threatens, how it breeds. But always forbidden is the one question that might open the door. Who?
That is a question at the center of this book. I wonder if you can unpack that question for us. What are you thinking of when you're asking the question, who?
We, as human beings, are defined by our relationships to others. And we are not unique in that. There are other kinds of animals that are completely defined by their relationships to others, such as elephants and certain kinds of whales and wolves. And they know who they are, and they know who their friends are. They know who their rivals are. They aspire to higher status. They wait for their chance to challenge the existing order. And those animals are who animals, and we are among them. And then because everything about life occurs on a sliding scale, on a continuum, there are some that are largely defined by their relationships to others. There are some that are a little bit defined. Like, for instance, birds in the breeding season, they know who they are, they know where their nest is, they know who their mate is. Many of them recognize their specific chicks. But after the breeding season, not so much. But everything is on a continuum. So you have everything all the way from something like a mosquito, which has no social life except to find a mate at some point, all the way up to an elephant or a killer whale who will stay with their mother for their entire life, which may span 50 or 60 years, or sometimes, in the case of killer whales, more than that.
And it's not just these higher order animals. I mean, you even give some examples of insects that seem to have an understanding of their relationship to others.
Right. So I wanted to cast a wide net and keep an open mind, because an open mind is the most scientific thing you can really have. And I was interested really in how other animals experience living. How vivid are their lives? And it turns out that, you know, for many of them, life is very vivid, and they have superhuman senses. Many of them have much better eyesight, or much better hearing, or much better smell. Many of them are long-distance migrants whose sense of the world that they inhabit is not just a small neighborhood or even a big neighborhood, but it's, you know, it's really truly vast, and yet they can find their way there and back. So I wanted, you know, to ask the question of how are their brains like our brains, and what do they do that either shows or suggests that they know what's going on, that they learn things. In the case of, you know, many mammals and many birds, there's really a lot going on with them. But it's interesting to speculate about even invertebrates, like many kinds of insects or crayfish or things like that, because their nervous system, the nerves all look the same under a microscope. So it's a matter of how those nerves are connected and what they do, but they also produce the same chemicals that in humans give us our moods and our motivations. And that is evidence, along with their behavior, that all makes sense. You know, something that you threaten reacts as though it's scared or defensive. So that makes sense, right? So this is all evidence that they are experiencing something. The closer to humans you get, like mammals, the more like our experiences they appear to be having. So that the explorations in the book are really all about this question. You know, what is life like for us all, including all the non-humans that share the world with us? And how do they value their lives?
You actually turn the notion around. Not only are you looking at how animals are like us, but there's even a more profound question, which is, how are we like them? In other words, the kinship that we have with them derives in some way from how much we are like animals, like other animals.
Sure. There are actually two big questions here, I would say. One is this question you just posed. How are they like us, and how are we like them? It's sort of the same question. And humans are animals, so our thoughts and our emotions are the thoughts and emotions of animals. The other question, which I actually think is more interesting, is who are they, like us or not? Because if we ask, how are they like us, that's a question about us. And if we ask, does my dog really love me or does she just want a treat, that's a question about us. We are the animal kingdom's greatest narcissists, certainly. And we are essentially, you know, almost all the time only interested in ourselves. Even when we ask about other animals, we ask about what do they think of us. So the question that I ask at the beginning of the book, that also runs through the whole book, is who are they? And what is life like for them? Along a gigantic spectrum, not just the ones that the book focuses on, but all the others that are included by reference in the book.
Now, this is a question that, as you say, has not only gone unexplored, but there's been active persecution of scientists who try to explore this question. How did the notion that animals did not have consciousness even come about?
I think the notion that they do not have consciousness is fairly associated with Descartes, who said that they don't. And the other issue is whether science could ask the question, what is happening in the inner lives of other animals? And The reason that scientists could not ask that question, I think, is different. And I think it's because the first scientist who started to try to make a science of animal behavior, which was recent, only in about the 1940s and 50s, they had to establish that this is a serious science. So they had to get rid of all the caricatures about animals that, you know, that grasshoppers are lazy and that foxes are clever. And so basically they said, okay, look, we're starting with a blank slate here, and we're just going to describe what they do. That will be the science of animal behavior. We can't know what's going on in their mind. We have no way of asking that question. And so we won't do that. And those people were geniuses, and they started a new science. But the geniuses were followed by their students, and those people just said, well, we're not allowed to ask those questions, and neither are you. And this became a straitjacket that became totally unreasonable, because at first they were saying, look, we have to have an open mind here. Grasshoppers are not lazy. Foxes are not clever. We'll just watch them and see what they do. And then that open-mindedness turned into a total closed door on exactly the same kind of question. Well, what do they really do? And what do they experience? You just were not allowed to ask that. But when they started, no one had systematically watched animals in the wild do their thing. And no one had even watched animals in laboratory experiments. It was new. The point is, there was nothing to go on. And we knew very little about the brain and the nervous system in the 1940s compared to now. And now there's just really a lot more to go on. And you can make a lot of very reasonable speculations about what's going on, but you can also see what they're doing, and you can draw on thousands of studies of the behavior of animals in the wild and behavior of animals in laboratory experiments and what they do. You can look at an incredible amount of new stuff that we know about brains and nervous systems and hormonal systems and how they create emotional responses and mood responses or mood disorders and things like that.
One of the things you talk about in this book, Carl Safina, in Beyond Words, is the whole notion of theory of mind. You reserve some of your most acid pen, I'd say, in critiquing this notion of theory of mind. I'd like to ask you first to explain what it is, but then also talk about the whole mirror experiment. I think probably a lot of our listeners are familiar with that. Mm-hmm. And this is the notion that animals, most animals don't recognize themselves in the mirror is still pretty common.
Yeah, and that's true. Most animals don't recognize themselves in the mirror, but we'll get to that. So you asked me first about theory of mind. One of the problems with all these concepts, these labels like theory of mind, self-awareness, even intelligence, sentience, consciousness, all of these very important words, is that they don't have an accepted definition in the field of behavior. People argue about these things using very different definitions. Just for instance, some people say that consciousness is the ability to think forward and backward in time and ponder one's own death. And other people say consciousness is having sensations and a mental experience. So the first thing is you have to define what you're talking about with these terms in order to talk about what you're talking about. So this terribly awkward sounding term, theory of mind, is defined very differently by some different people. The most useful definition is it's the ability to understand that another individual can have different thoughts and a different agenda, have different interests than you do. That's not a problem because that's a useful thing to talk about. The problem is that many people have insisted that only human beings are able to know that another has thoughts and another has potentially the same or a different or competing agenda. And there are hundreds of studies insisting that theory of mind is a human attribute and no other animals have it. But that's patently absurd. And the thing that really strikes me is how incredibly dense many people are, or ignorant many people are who write about this, about what other animals do. When an animal sees a predator, for instance, it knows that the predator's agenda may not be the same as its agenda, and it responds very appropriately. When a dog runs around to the front of you with a ball in its mouth, it knows that when you're not facing the dog, it needs to get your attention, and you're capable of throwing the ball, and it can anticipate the pleasure of that. There are other animals that lie, and this is very well documented, that people have seen on numerous occasions things like a monkey will give an alarm call that scatters everybody, but there is no danger. It's just that that was a low-ranking monkey who wasn't getting any fruit in the tree and wanted to clear everybody out so it could quickly grab a couple of handfuls of fruit before it was again chased away by the higher-ranking ones. Somebody watched a group of hyenas where they were walking along and the lowest-ranking, youngest hyena happened to turn its head and glance directly at a leopard that was crouched over a kill it had just made. None of the other hyenas noticed it. So what did the low-ranking hyena do? Absolutely nothing until they all walked over a hill and then it came running back to grab that kill because it knew that if it had gone on a beeline, it wouldn't get any of it. Chimpanzees do stuff like that a lot. There are numerous examples of different animals that understand enough about who's competing with them and whose interests are not the same as theirs that it's worth lying about it. Not to mention things like play and invitation to play and other kinds of engagement or running away from a dangerous individual or a potential predator. So how hundreds of papers could be published insisting that only humans have this theory of mind capacity is to me completely mind-boggling. It makes no sense at all. And I think it's because, like many of these things, we don't give any animals any credit, and it's so easy not to give them any credit because it reinforces our favorite story, which is we are completely unique and we are the best there is, and there's nothing in our category. And that's totally false on every level. I mean, biologically, we're part of a process. So you just see that everywhere you actually look, if you look.
That was Carl Safina talking with Writer's Voice in 2015 about his book Beyond Words, How Animals Think and Feel. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to the entire interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.